former Surgeon General of the United States has pleaded not guilty to charges she used New York State employees to work overtime to handle her personal business. Dr. Antonia Novello is also the former New York State Health Commissioner. She faces 20 counts of fraud. Novello says all the charges against her are politically motivated. The Federal Trade Commission says it is close to filing lawsuits against companies using a blast of robocalls on people's cell phones. The calls warn consumers their auto warranties are about to expire. New York Senator Charles Schumer, who got one of the calls, says some 300,000 people have complained. He points out the unwanted calls violate the federal Do Not Call law, and he says the calls use up people's cell phone minutes, and that means cell phone bills can go up. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. Gene Redpath is a prolific recording artist and one of the definitive interpreters of Scottish traditional songs. Through her friendship with Julie Byler, director of Champaign-Urbana's Chorale, she visits this area frequently, and we'll have the privilege of her company and the pleasure of hearing her sing live in our studio on the Tuesday edition of Live and Local, your connection to local music, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign. Now serving dine-in, lunch, and dinner daily from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., featuring a Middle Eastern menu along with hot soup, Turkish coffee, and herbal teas. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williams and Martha Dill, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about some of the challenges now being faced by the American auto industry, concentrating particularly on recent experiences of General Motors, the company that was at one time the biggest automaker in the world. There are a lot of people who question the federal assistance that has been offered and may yet come to help companies like General Motors. And the question that we'll talk about this morning is, well, was that the right thing to do? Was the government right to extend loans to help GM and also Chrysler? There certainly are people who would say the answer to that question would be no. They would say the American auto industry simply should be allowed to die. We just don't need to make cars anymore in this country. However, our guest for this hour, business journalist William Holstein, he offers a different answer. In fact, that he says that before the economic crisis hit, General Motors was on the brink of a successful transformation. In fact, he says it might well have been one of the biggest, most significant transformations in American industry ever. Now he has some questions about whether or not that's going to happen and what lies ahead for GM. But he does make the point that if General Motors were to go under, that certainly would deal a very serious blow to the nation's economy, because there are a lot of people one way or another, either in a direct way or a slightly more indirect way, whose jobs depend on this company. He has written about all of this in a newly published book. The title of his book is Why GM Matters. The subtitle is Inside the Race to Transform an American Icon, and Walker & Company is the publisher of the book. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. William Holstein has written for Business Week, The New York Times, and Fortune, among other publications. He worked also at U.S. News, and he went to work there in 1996. He covered the American economy with a specialization in autos. He's also a board member of the International Motor Press Association, and he's joining us by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, that's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So here locally, 333-9455, so that's for Champaign-Urbana. But anybody else, use the toll-free line. The call's on us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point, questions welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along. But anybody who's listening is welcome to call. Mr. Holstein, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I think that one basic point that you make, and this is based on having had the opportunity to spend a lot of time in and around GM and talking with people in the company, that you know, people, particularly those people who say we shouldn't be trying to help the auto industry, they say things like, well, if they're going down, it's their fault. That we have companies here who were badly organized. The product wasn't good. They had very, very bad poisonous relations with their workers. The products were, they're not good. They were too expensive. They weren't what people wanted. And here, if they would say, you know, if the company falls apart, well, it's kind of their problem. You seem to be making the argument, at least when it comes to GM, that at one point all of that criticism you would say perfectly fair, but that there was a certain point where GM was actually addressing all of those issues,
right.
And maybe if it wasn't for the credit crunch, we wouldn't be talking about the need of bailout or the possibility of bankruptcy.
Yeah, this whole debate about General Motors is dominated by what I call, you know, the myths. One myth is General Motors can't make cars that Americans want. That's a myth. General Motors can't innovate. That's a myth. General Motors couldn't respond to international competition. That's a myth. General Motors wasn't prepared to drive down their cost structure. That's a myth. I mean, the company had been doing all these things in earnest for 5, 6, 7 years since Rick Wagoner became chief executive in the year 2000. They were in a historically very deep hole, and the very organization was wrong. They were not organized to respond to Toyota, so they were very slow in doing it, but they were in the process of a successful transformation by next year. So this is a key point of in the whole public policy debate about General Motors. Are they in this situation because of their errors and their mistakes, and therefore they ought to disappear? Isn't that the American way? Versus looking at it in terms of here's what they were trying to do. They're on the brink of success, and they were ambushed by this global economic collapse. There was a collapse. The auto market in this country collapsed from 17 million or 16 million units a year to 9.5. So I lean in the direction of saying that, yes, historically there were some, they made mistakes, they weren't perfect, but they were in the process of pulling off the most dramatic industrial transformation in American history until they were ambushed by this economic crisis.
Yeah.
And one point of argumentation is, look what's happening to Toyota. Toyota, if Toyota were making money hand over fist in this market, then I think you could say, well, look, Toyota's got it right, and General Motors failed. It's their fault. But Toyota also is losing money for the first time in many, many decades. Toyota also is stumbling badly. So nobody's making money in this market. This is a moment of economic crisis, and I think that accounts for more a majority of what went wrong, not a minority.
Yeah, I think that seems to me to be an important point to make, that yes, indeed, the American automakers are facing very difficult times, but it's not really good for anybody. The Japanese car makers, the European car makers, the economic problems that the U.S. automakers are facing, they're affecting everybody.
Right. So once you start with that recognition, then you ask yourself, well, should they be punished? Should we be punishing them by forcing them into bankruptcy? There's a certain whiff of punishment in the air that they have this coming. We want to push them into bankruptcy. We want to force firing Rick Wagoner, for example, was clearly a scapegoating, finding punishment. So, I mean, I think that the government has operating on the wrong set of premises. That there was a so-called failure of leadership. That's what President Obama said. And I think the government is operating on the premise that they need to push General Motors into bankruptcy so that the courts can save General Motors. My argument is that if they, in fact, they push General Motors into bankruptcy on June 1st, that they are playing with the very life of this company, which is such a vital part of the American economy, that the hopes that we have right now that we've stabilized our economy, that we've reached bundling around along the bottom of the economy. If in fact General Motors goes into bankruptcy and then the assembly lines stop, and when they face liquidation, then we're going to look at a whole other level of rationing downward of this economy.
Yeah. You, again, just to go back to what you were saying before, you really give credit to Rick Wagner for being involved in pushing a number of things and doing things that were helping to turn the company around. And also you mentioned, as people I'm sure will recall, that in late March he was forced to resign by the Obama administration. And
right.
that was part of the deal of where the administration is saying, okay, we'll see what we can do for you, but we got problems with your management and we'd like and I guess it wasn't so much we'd like, it was that Mr. Wagner will resign. I think I've seen you talking about this and that you said that you actually were shocked by that.
Well, Steve Rattner, this investment banker boy from New York who bought his way into the Obama administration, called Rick Wagner into his office in the Treasury Department and said, you're out. And out as not off, not only out of the role of chief executive of the company, but also out of your role as chairman of the board, your association with the company is over. So Rick Wagner was fired and dismissed like a schoolboy by the beginning of business on the following Tuesday. So that was just, it was punitive. It was scapegoating. I don't know who Steve Rattner thinks he is, but he clearly had no idea that Wagner was a man who had pushed the company to widely absorb and improve upon the Toyota manufacturing system. This is an incredible story that you in the Midwest, I'm sure, understand. The design capability of General Motors had improved dramatically. They had invested $1 billion in the lithium-ion battery for the Chevy Volt, which is an effort to leapfrog the Toyota Prius. Rick Wagner had begun the process with the UAW of persuading them to take on responsibility for their own health care costs and to implement a two-tier wage system. So Rick Wagner had reversed decades of management acquiescence to steadily increasing demands from the UAW, and he was in the process of driving $5,000 out of the cost of every car by the year 2010. So he maybe was not enough of a son of a bitch. Some people said he should have moved faster to close more brands, close more dealers, and I think the historical argument about him will be, was he mean-spirited enough? Well, did he fire enough people? Did he close enough factories fast enough? But there's just no question but that he was moving in the right direction. So the administration's decision to fire him this summarily was based on a complete ignorance of anything that actually had been happening inside the company.
Well, let me ask you one more quick question, and then I have a couple of callers here. I promise them I will not make them wait too much longer. We want to get them in. But why is it that it seems that nobody really knew what really was happening at GM, these kinds of things that you've talked about that would really started to turn things around? It seemed obvious, certainly on Capitol Hill, when representatives of the industry went there to ask for help, going back last fall, that obviously people there hadn't heard the story. And,
no.
You know, the Congress basically said, no, you can't have any money. And so the Bush administration took TARP money
right.
and gave it to GM. And now there's still some question about, you know, will there be help and under what sort of circumstances? And are we looking at bankruptcy and so forth? Why is it that it seems that no one really had heard the story about what was happening at GM?
Well, partly it's a failure of the business media that they've cut back so much that business journalists don't have the time to do what I did, which was to go to the GM facilities in three continents and spend days talking to workers and spend days talking to designers. And instead of basing the media commentary on a solid understanding of what's happening inside the company, I found in promoting the book that the media has a very ideologicalized approach to it, that on the one end you have the Fox and Wall Street Journal and CNBC who are campaigning against General Motors, trying to drive them into bankruptcy because they want to see the union get broken. They hate the union. Then from the other end of the ideological spectrum, MSNBC, The New York Times, others, they are against General Motors because they see it as a giant polluting evil company and see it as being hard on the union. So that's what the business media has failed. That's point one. Point two is there's been a shift in the national debate about General Motors, partly because of the rise of the southern transplant states. This has surprised everybody just how influential southern Republicans have been, southern Republicans who have transplant factories from Honda, Toyota, or other companies in their states. That's a major new piece of the political equation, as is the rise of the California environmental political lobby. So, I mean, it's quietly, without General Motors seeming to be aware of it, the national media and the national ideological debate tilted against them. So when it came time for trying to get some help from Washington, which they assumed would be a relatively easy thing to do, they ran into a firestorm. So they were surprised by that. They weren't prepared well. That their whole issue of taking the jets in was, in retrospect, a disaster. So they were surprised by the depth of hostility that the entire American media and political elite seem to feel for them.
We have a couple of calls. We'll get right to them right now. Let me again introduce our guest, William Holstein. He's a business writer. He has written for a number of publications, including Business Week, The New York Times, U.S. News and World Report, and Fortune, and is the author of a recent book, Why GM Matters, Inside the Race to Transform an American Icon. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and we'll start with someone here where we are in Urbana, line one.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question that maybe might speak to attitude or to, managerial CEO kinds of decisions, and it's maybe three parts. When did GM, and they were not the only automaker, when did they start paying millions of dollars in legal fees to go up against the CAFE standards that were set by the state of California? I mean, to me, that speaks to a mindset that says, no, we're not going to build cars that get better gas mileage. The second one is, so how long ago were they doing that? Was the CEO that was dumped, was he a person who was supporting that? And the second question is, are they still doing that? Are they using some of this money that's been given to them to continue to pay their lawyers to fight those CAFE standards? I'll get off and let you talk.
All right.
Well, yes, General Motors has been against some of these CAFE standards, particularly against what the Californians are trying to do. The Californians are trying to say that there should be a standard that applies to their state only. And this would make it almost impossible to manufacture cars in a profitable, rational way. So, yes, Rick Wagoner was against that, and the company is still against what California is proposing. The issue is bounced before the EPA now. We don't know how it's going to play out. So this obviously, these questions are a reference point for the whole debate about General Motors and its attitude toward fuel-efficient cars. They did experiment with it at one point with the EV1 in California in the 90s, and they concluded that the technological and marketing and commercial challenges were just too great. They ended up pulling those vehicles off of leases and taking them back. And they were convinced for many years that it just was not possible to make electric vehicles. Then when Bob Lutz got there, he demanded that they try it again. And they are now trying to launch the Chevy Bolt, which with the lithium-ion battery. So they've invested about $1 billion in that, and they have about 8 hybrid vehicles out now. So they have softened their hard opposition by coming out with vehicles that they think will sell and that they think will be innovative and more fuel efficient. But so there's not a contradiction between trying to do that. At the same time, you try to resist California implementing what most people regard as highly arbitrary and highly irrational regulations.
All right, let's go to Huntley, the next caller on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hey, good morning. I like this stuff. Love it. I had a chance to talk to a gentleman that has a couple of dealerships, and I can explain part of this that you haven't brought up yet, okay? One, GM and Chrysler have a problem solely because if you build it, they will come. In other words, the Cadillac Escalade, the truck, and the SUV, and other vehicles like that, people kept buying them off the floors. They couldn't, and the guy said, I couldn't keep them in stock. Okay, same thing with Ford, the Excursions, and Chevy has the Tahoes. You could not keep the SUVs in stock until. What was it, a year ago, a couple years ago?
In the second quarter of last year.
Five gas,
yeah.
And that drove that everybody stopped buying cars just because of this. This is before the presidency got changed and all this. And they're trying to, you know, blame somebody for this. But the bottom line, and I agree with you on this, by the way, that Rick Wagner shouldn't have been ousted. Part of the problem is, and California is a good example, whatever happens in California, 99% of the time is going to happen in other parts of this country. It's insane. I mean, the tariffs that we have on our car manufacturers versus what, you know, in turn they do to us, it's ridiculous. It's the car guys are at a disadvantage. No matter how you look, if it's an American car, it's at a disadvantage. Now, Toyota, I understand, is having a problem, and so is Nissan, I guess, right?
Right. Everyone is losing money. Right.
Right. Now, I heard something the other day. I'm a NASCAR fan, okay, but you got Penske was talking about buying, and I didn't know that he was full of money, but he's talking about buying Saturn and keeping that going, which is a good idea. I think part of the problem is having the government take over this. If they fail, people don't realize how much of a problem this is going to be.
Well, the government should not take this over. I mean, that's one major point I'd like to make, and I'll respond to your question, but that the idea that the government should take over and manage General Motors is lunacy. This is a complex, huge industrial enterprise that bases needs technology, needs decisions about marketing, about finance. The idea that the federal government should take it over and run it is just nuts. Just can't do it. It'd be a colossal error. But what is the question you're asking me, sir?
I'm not exactly sure. You want to ask a more direct kind of question that the guest can deal with?
Well, I was going to say, why is it what everybody's advertising all these big high-priced electric or hybrid cars, nobody's buying them? Because
if you talk
to these gentlemen, they're not buying enough to keep a keep anybody afloat. And the same thing with the Volt. Nobody is buying the Volt.
Well, it's not on sale yet, but this is part of the whole debate about General Motors. There are people in Washington, including in the Obama administration, who believe that they should force General Motors to put more cars on the market that are environmentally correct, however you define that. But the reality is that the American people want speed, they want size, and they're not willing to pay the extra money for extra battery technology. So, I mean, I hate to use the word just ideologues, but they are ideologically committed to this idea that Americans must buy cars of a certain description, and they want to force General Motors to do that. That is the recipe for tragic outcomes, because I guess last time I checked, Americans still buy the cars they want. They don't buy the cars that people, environmentalists, demand that they buy. So there's a lot of confusion here about what should be really trying to do. Helping General Motors survive. Should we try to help them survive as an entity that employs thousands of people, buys billions of dollars worth of technology, supports communities across the country, or should we turn them into an environmental stalking horse and try to force them down a certain path? So it's a big debate, and there's huge confusion over it.
Well, let me ask you this question, following up on something that the caller said. I think that I can imagine people at GM feeling really frustrated at that point when suddenly there was a big spike up in oil prices,
right,
and then it seemed like people were having a hard time filling the tanks of these big vehicles that previously they had bought and driven, and there started to be some more interest and pressure on automakers to deliver more fuel-efficient vehicles. Now, and the criticism of GM was, well, you're not making the cars that people want. Well, at that moment, maybe, but how did they react to that when they thought, well, you know, it wasn't that long ago that what people want, just like what the caller said, what people wanted were, they wanted SUVs. They wanted these big cars, and, you know, so they were buying them. It's just that something happened here that we didn't, maybe nobody expected.
Yeah, there was a major change in consumer psychology in the second quarter last year when gasoline prices neared $4 a gallon. People, it's like a light bulb went off, and overnight, I mean, people have been talking about the moment coming for a decade or more, but it never came until the second quarter of last year, and then, boom, the world turned, even though prices now have declined slightly, and even though sales of the Prius and the Civics are off in view of that, there has been a fundamental change in the psychology. So General Motors has responded by, they have the Impala, they have the Chevy Malibu, they have the Cruze out, they have the Aveo out. The Chevrolet lineup has lots of very fuel-efficient cars. They have the 8 hybrids out now and some of the larger vehicles. The Saturn lineup is very environmentally correct, friendly. So they, I mean, General Motors has products on the marketplace that are very attractive, they're priced right, and are more fuel efficient than what they were selling 10 years ago. The idea that they haven't responded is just nuts. I mean, that point of view comes from people who haven't been to a dealership.
Why, though? I think so. One of the questions people ask is, why should it be so difficult to build a highly fuel-efficient car? And I'm not talking here about a gas-electric hybrid. I'm talking about one with a conventional internal combustion engine that burns gasoline. It seems that some car makers, at least, can produce vehicles that get very high gas mileage. And why should that be so difficult?
Well, General Motors, the new Camaro coming out, the V6 version of that gets 29 miles to the gallon. The V8 version gets 25 miles to the gallon. So General Motors has improved their engines over time. They're not putting out the same vehicles they were putting out in the 80s or 90s. Their gasoline, the internal combustion engine, has improved in efficiency. So they have responded on that level as well.
But I guess I'm thinking about, you know, why shouldn't we be able to build a car that gets 50 miles to a gallon or better?
Well, I don't know the ultimate answer to that question. The Volt that is going to be a lithium-ion battery car will have a gasoline engine associated with it, but the car will always be operated on battery. So if you drive it only 40 miles a day, you'd never use a drop of gasoline. You'd have no emissions whatsoever. So that's better than a gasoline engine that gets 50 miles per gallon, because there'd be no emissions, zero emissions. Nothing would enter the atmosphere at all except for water.
And you think this is a car that's really poised to mount a significant challenge to the Prius?
Yes. The lithium-ion battery is lighter, can hold more energy, can handle more recharges. So the debate, we hear what you read in the hostile press about it is, oh, it's going to be priced at $35,000. Who's going to want to do that? Well, there are a number of enthusiasts who are going to go for it, even at that level. And then here's what happens. After they get it into the market, then they can start driving down the cost of the components, just like happened in the semiconductor industry or in the liquid crystal display industry. You have to make a lot of something before you can drive down the cost of it. You have to build up a whole infrastructure of people who know how to make these lithium-ion batteries, cells and packs. It's often dismissed. Oh, they're only going to sell 10,000 volts at $35,000, and so big deal, what's it all about? That's not where the story ends. The story ends, Rick Wagoner's told me he wanted to sell, he could envision an era of selling 500,000 of these, 500,000 of these at $20,000. So that's obviously a couple, 3 years out, but if they can achieve that objective, then that really, really moves the needle in terms of our dependence on energy from abroad and moves the needle in terms of the emissions of the entire automotive fleet.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, William Holstein. He's written for Business Week, The New York Times, U.S. News and World Report, Fortune. He's written a good deal on the auto industry. He's the author of a recently published book. The title is Why GM Matters, Inside the Race to Transform an American Icon. Walker & Company is the publisher. We're at our midpoint here. We have some other callers. We'll get back to the phones next to talk with somebody in the community of Belgium, not that far away here. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning again. First, one point I'd like to make, sir, is electric cars are not without emission. They get their power from coal-fired power plants that produce a lot of carbon dioxide. So it's just you put all the pollution in one point instead of all over the world.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
But that's not what I'm wanting to get at. What I want to point out is that General Motors and all the car companies, the only thing they advertise for years and years, and they're still doing it today, is let's get you in a big car so that we can continue using the plants that we do have in production right now. Now, we Americans, I'm sorry to say, are a bunch of gullible individuals that will follow anything we see on television or we hear on radio. And that is the reason why we can continue to buy these gas-guzzling, unsellable cars right now, as you can see, because we're sold a bill of goods. that's where General Motors has really gone wrong. If they would have started out years ago advertising efficient, highly engineered cars, we would be driving those cars today.
Well, I don't know that that's true. I mean, many Americans need larger vehicles for pets, large families. They have boats they want to pull to the lake. They have horses they want to pull around. I mean, many Americans have legitimate needs for larger vehicles. So, I mean, you ask the American people, what do you want? They want utility. They want size. They want pulling power. They want speed. I mean, I don't know what the numbers would be, but the number of people out there who are willing to put the money behind a small fuel-efficient car is 10%, 5% of the market. Just not that. I mean, that's just the reality of who Americans are. I don't think that General Motors has brainwashed Americans into wanting cars of a certain dimension.
I must take exception with you there, sir. There are a lot of suburban housewives that don't pull anything bigger than their children in the back seat, and they all seem to drive the biggest SUV they can find. Thank you very much.
All right. I don't know. You have any response for that?
Well, many women in particular feel safer in larger vehicles. They choose to have these vehicles so that they can feel safe for themselves and their families. Should we deny them that? Should we make them drive smaller cars where they feel vulnerable? Should we make them drive cars that they don't want to drive? Again, I come back to the central point. Americans buy the kind of cars they want.
Well, let's go to Champaign County next. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. It wasn't that long ago that Americans wanted the kind of car that the Earth needs. We need to go to a smaller and more efficient vehicle. We actually need a lot more mass transit, too, but that's a whole other discourse. But I just wanted to point that out. It wasn't that long ago, and I've actually heard a gentleman on the Farm Report point out that the cost of our military is part of our cost of oil. And if you start adding that in, as we've had illustrated today, there are a lot of, in the last couple of days, there are a lot of unintended consequences of that, and that I think should be totaled in. And so, I mean, you can say that Americans, it wasn't that long ago that Priuses were going really fast, and there was a waiting list. And when the gas price reflects, you know, the true cost to the world, people are going to be wanting these cars again. What do you think of that?
I have no idea, but I mean, I'm not against fuel-efficient cars. Let me get this straight. I hate the idea that we depend on the Middle East for oil and that we're transferring hundreds of billions of dollars into the hands of people who fundamentally disagree with our morals and our values and attempt to want to destroy us. I think that's dumb. I think that's really stupid. I think that if we want to move the country toward more fuel efficiency, one of the first things we ought to do is put on a gasoline tax, and gasoline prices ought to be held steady at about $4 or $5 a gallon. That would trigger a whole series of things. We ought to have this Department of Energy money. Billions of dollars have been tied up. That money ought to start getting moved into the hands of people doing more research on batteries and other kinds of alternative energy sources. There ought to be this cash for clunkers idea is a good one. The government ought to be giving money to people to get out of cars that are 10 years old. So there are a whole series of policy prescriptions that I can offer to you that would start moving the country toward much more fuel efficiency, and they'd be very unpopular. I mean, if you put on a gasoline tax like that, there would be riots in certain cities. It would force a redistribution of where we live. Many people now live in big McMansions with their big vehicles 40 or 50 miles away from where they work. So it would force a whole change in the suburban and exurban sprawl. I mean, so it could be done, but it would take at least 10 years to do, and it would be very unpopular, but it could be done. That's the right way to create a climate where we're less dependent on energy, and that reflects the proper role of government. Trying to use the bankruptcy of General Motors or the difficulties of General Motors to single-handedly transform America's energy picture is just the wrong approach.
I certainly agree with that, and I agree with your major thesis that we need a manufacturing sector that includes, whatever part of the mix. But it seems to me that the idea that the market is going to get us there, and there actually is a way to raise the gas price and rebate to lower income people.
Or invest that in mass transportation projects.
Of course, but that would actually also, you know, and the roads would last longer, too. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, let me ask you another question here, and then we'll get back to some callers, something that we kind of brushed by earlier, and that is that some people would say that as long as we have some automakers working in building cars in plants in the United States, employing people, that it, in a sense, that it doesn't matter who they are. And so these are the people who would say, well, does it matter if GM goes down as long as we have people who are working in the United States in plants building Hondas or Toyotas?
Well, I've heard that argument, obviously. Here's what people don't understand who make that argument. For every one of those jobs on the line in Ohio or Michigan or Illinois or wherever it is, there are 9 to 10 other jobs. There are people who design cars. That takes an advanced degree. They're highly compensated. There are other people who design the cars, who figure out how do we make these parts. Those people, again, have advanced educations, use information technology extensively. There are other people who are manufacturing engineers who decide how the line can run. And on it goes. I mean, GM buys $3 billion a year worth of information technology. They're the largest buyer in the private sector in this country. They support lots of people with MBAs. They support lots of people who are doing the marketing and advertising of these vehicles. So the General Motors jobs on the line support a rich mix of higher-skilled jobs that are here in this country. If those jobs, the manufacturing jobs are in Tennessee or Alabama, where do you think the higher-end jobs are? They're back in Japan, they're in Korea, they're in Germany. We basically, this whole argument that we just let Toyota take over, that what that would mean is we'd wipe out the class of people, a managerial and professional class of people who are involved in designing, manufacturing, or engineering, marketing, managing the company. So it's a spurious argument. It just doesn't make any sense. It reflects a gross absence of knowledge about how these companies operate.
All right, let's take another caller here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I'd just like to reiterate that the problem is not, doesn't need a, well, it's not a technical problem that we don't have manufacturers producing fuel-efficient, high-quality cars here. It's an economic problem. I mean, the reason why the Asians and the Europeans do it is because they pay twice as much for gasoline as we do. But we don't have the political will in this country to, you know, do that. And that I think is the real crux of the problem. And, you know, we would have just as good high quality efficient cars if, you know, we were paying for gasoline what people in the rest of the world are doing.
It's true. I mean, we have built our whole economic model since World War II on the basis of mobility. The suburbs sprouted in the 1950s, all predicated on the car. A lot of the white population moved out of major urban areas into suburban areas. Again, the car was the enabler that allowed that to happen. I mean, the very structure of our society has been built on mobility. And to now reverse that by imposing a high gasoline tax would be very painful, would be just very unpopular. There are lots of other things we can do short of some sort of full-scale revolution in our society. We can promote alternative energies. There are a lot of things we can do. But again, this comes back to how should we be treating General Motors? Should we be turning them into the vehicle, no pun intended, that is going to redress decades of American economic and political decision making? That's just not realistic. That will destroy General Motors, and that will have very serious economic consequences.
Well, you know, we used to have the best mass transit system in the world until General Motors and I think it was Phillips Oil and others went together and bought it up and put it out of business so that, you know, they would not have that competition. So I think we really need to find the political will somehow to start, creating a mixed economy where we kind of redirect some of the dollars into producing, you know, a more sustainable and livable society. Thank you.
All right. Let me take just a moment. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about Saturn, just because it seemed that when the Saturn was introduced, it got very high marks for design, performance. A lot of people said, well, this is a really good car. People seem to appreciate the fact that their style was a little bit different. They were trying to do something a little bit different, the way the cars were retailed. And initially, the car seemed to be very successful and well-received. And then the company starved Saturn of resources. And very quickly, people felt that the quality declined. And I guess now maybe there's some question about, does Saturn have any future at all? What happened with the Saturn?
Well, it's a sad story, and I'm particularly upset about that. I think the lineup of Saturn vehicles right now, starting with the Sky and the Aura, is first class vehicles right now on the roads. So you outlined the rough history. They were a startup in response to Japanese competition. They were very promising. Then they were starved for resources because the Oldsmobile guys or the Chevrolet guys or the Cadillac guys would say, we want the dollars from General Motors. We don't want those dollars going to Saturn. So they were starved for a while. Then they were reabsorbed into the General Motors manufacturing system. The company decided to centralize the way it designed and manufactured vehicles as part of their effort, again, to respond to Toyota and to improve the efficiency of how they did that. So the Saturn separate manufacturing went away. And so now you have a dealership network with fine vehicles in it, but they've just never been able to make money from it. And so now they're on the chopping block. So I've heard about different people wanting to buy it. The one mystery I have is, well, how will they make the cars? Where will the cars come from? Mm-hmm. Will they make them under contract from General Motors? Who will make the cars? So that's a mystery to me, and the whole story of Saturn is a sad story.
Well, one of the criticisms of the company, recent criticisms, it maybe goes back to its very founding when the guy who started it said the ambition here is a vehicle for every price point, you know, for everybody, for every pocketbook, we have a car. But now it seems that's one of the criticisms is, well, you've got too many nameplates, you got too many models, you got too many brands, you got too many dealers. And now, of course, there's going to be contraction. We know there will be fewer dealers, fewer nameplates, Pontiacs going away. Was that a fair criticism? Were they just making too many different vehicles?
Well, it started off, Billy Durant was the one who created the company in 1908, and he smashed car companies together. He bought Buick and Pontiac, and he did not even attempt to focus them on any kind of coherent approach to the market. It was Alfred P. Sloan in the 1920s who introduced the tiering system where Chevrolet was at the bottom, and you built up your way up to the Buick and Pontiac, to the Oldsmobile, and to Cadillac on top. That model worked tremendously well for many, many decades.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at one point in 1961, they had 50-some-odd percentage of the American market. The Justice Department was talking about having to break them up. They were so powerful. And in that environment, with that large of a market share, the multi-brand strategy, the multi-company strategy worked. Now they're down at 20 or below, and now across, I mean, this, one of the things Rick Wagoner tried to do was try to maintain brands in hopes that they could be revitalized, maintain the dealer networks, and maintain the factories in hopes that they could find the answer and revitalize and rebuild and go back on the growth trajectory. Now what the company is being demanded of the company is, no, we want you to be ready to compete at 10 million units a year. So get rid of all the brands, get rid of the factories, get rid of the dealers. And so that's what Fritz Henderson is now on the path of doing. So it's the most radical thing that General Motors has ever done.
Our guest is William Holstein. He's a business writer. He's written for Business Week, New York Times, U.S. News and World Report, Fortune. He's written a lot about the auto industry. His new book is Why GM Matters, Inside the Race to Transform an American Icon. Walker & Company is the publisher. We're coming down to about our last 6-7 minutes. We have some other callers. Let's get to the next, and that's Centralia, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I want to broaden the discussion a little bit, maybe. As recently as, it seems to me, even 2 years ago, General Motors was the company that was going to take off, and Ford was the one that was headed right to the ditch. What happened that caused Ford to be in a position where they're a little bit better off than the other, than General Motors and Chrysler? And are they really positioned to be safe? Are they just in a different position regarding their cash flow right now, and they're going to be in trouble in the long run?
Well, in the year 2006, the first thing Alan Mulally did was he leveraged every asset they had and mortgaged. They raised $23 billion in the year 2006. Even the Ford Oval, the Ford logo, has been mortgaged. They took out money against the value of that. So that has given them the cash cushion to, and then now, once General Motors got into problems and once the financial markets headed into free fall, it was not possible for General Motors to do the same thing. So Ford sailed into this very difficult period with cash, very different financial posture than General Motors. They have not done the same thing with their design of vehicles. They do not have a full product lineup. I mean, for a long time, they've been a company known as the Truck and Mustang Company. They've done a good job recently with the Ford Focus and the Ford Fusion, but they sacked the Taurus, and now they're rushing that back into the marketplace. General Motors has done a better job at having a full lineup of redesigned cars. Ford is behind them on that in that regard. They were ahead of them in the regard of borrowing money. So if sales linger here at 9.5 or 10 million units a year, Ford could be in the same soup within a year. They are profiting by they very cleverly have differentiated themselves from Ford, from GM and Chrysler. It's a very smart strategy. They just might get through this, and largely be because of how Alan Mulally borrowed money in the year 2006.
So they were a successful financial company, and never mind the automotive part of it.
Right, they were successful financially. Correct.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. And so, what do you think about the potential here now of the purchase of Chrysler by Fiat?
I think it's a joke. There's so much hype about this guy Marchionne from Fiat that he's going to come in here as some kind of messiah on a white horse and save Chrysler. He basically is trying to save Fiat, and he's trying to get money out of the American system so he can save his own company. So why, ask yourself one simple question. Why is Fiat not putting up money to buy majority control of Chrysler? They don't want it. They don't want majority control. I mean, so there is just a song. The American public and whoever is listening has been sold a bill of goods about this fellow.
Is overall, are we looking at an overall, you think, contraction in the auto industry worldwide?
Not necessarily. It's growing in China. GM has a 50% increase in sales in the most recent reporting period. India is growing. They have new vehicles over there. The Nano is going to be coming out from the Tata Motor Group. So much of the world wants cars, and so I think the emerging markets are going to be, there's going to be huge growth for cars and other places in the world. The question is, which companies are going to make those cars? Which companies are going to survive for the long term?
Well, and that's, I think, another area where you were giving points to Rick Wagoner for having had a vision for really becoming a bigger company, globally speaking. Is there still that possibility for GM to be one of the companies that's going to make and sell cars in the developing world?
Well, they're 60 or 65% of their sales in the last decent period they had were outside the United States. Mm-hmm. That number could easily hit 70 or 75%. They have globalized, and that's of course is controversial. Some people say, well, we're giving them, lending them money. Shouldn't they be creating jobs here? The same people, however, are telling them that they got to get competitive in this market. They've got to get downsized. So I don't think they have any choice, assuming they can survive. They have no choice but to continue to shrink here while they expand internationally.
Well, and again, I guess that gets us back to what you think is likely to happen here with the company in the near term. There's still some question about what the administration thinks about what the company is doing in terms of restructuring, whether money will be forthcoming. Could we still possibly see GM going into bankruptcy? What do you think is likely to happen?
Well, Well, I'm about 80 or 90% sure that the Obama administration is going to pull the trigger and push them into bankruptcy on June 1st, and I think it's going to be a disaster. I don't think the government has any idea of the scale, complexity of this enterprise, and it's thousands, tens of thousands of suppliers all across the country. Nor does I think the federal government and the bankruptcy lawyers who are advising them understand the tremendous loss of confidence at the dealer level and at the individual consumer's level that's going to occur. What we saw in the first quarter of this year when GM lost half of its revenue in this market is just a tiny taste of what's to come. Revenue is going to dry up, suppliers are going to go away, and the assembly lines are going to stop. And at that point, it's going to be liquidated. Just sell it to whoever will pay 10 cents on the dollar, if anyone will pay for it. So, I mean, this is really one of the most historic, most important moments in terms of the American government's management of the American economy. If they pull the trigger and force General Motors into bankruptcy on June 1st, I would predict that is going to create a major ratcheting downward of our whole economy.
And you think that's going to happen?
Yes. At this moment, the debate about it is gone silent. The people who understand this are marginalized and have been pushed to the side. The guys in the Obama task force are commanding the attention of major national newspapers, and it could be a quick, surgical, controlled bankruptcy. That just phooey. If you look at what happened to Delphi, the major auto parts maker, they went into bankruptcy in the year 2005, and they still can't get out. So I think there's just been a lot of loose talk about, you know, prepackaged, surgical, controlled bankruptcy. Once you get a company of this size into a bankruptcy court, anything can happen.
Well, what would be better? What would you say that if the administration came to you and said, well, what would you recommend we do? What would you say?
Take away the threat of bankruptcy. I mean, and send the signal to the American people that it's safe to buy these cars. The idea that the federal government can back up the warranties for 5 or 10 years is just nonsense. So, and then work with the financial people, work with the union to create make there's more haircuts may be necessary, but fundamentally the company has a viable business strategy now, and let them manage themselves, let them manage their way through to profitability, let them become a profitable company, let them start repaying the loans, but don't hang them out to dry by threatening bankruptcy, and certainly don't force them into bankruptcy. So it's not like they're fools. They're complete fools at General Motors. They have a plan, and they can execute this plan if they can get the right climate and get. I mean, people say to me, "Well, how long will this go?" I don't know how long this would go because we don't know when the American economy is going to really start showing real signs of strength. But to allow General Motors to go into bankruptcy right now would deeply compound the economic freefall that we've been feeling and that we've been trying to stabilize.
All right. Well, at that, we're going to have to finish up. For people who want to read more on the subject, the book to look for is Why GM Matters, Inside the Race to Transform an American Icon. It's published by Walker & Company by our guest, William Holstein. He's written for a number of publications, Business Week, New York Times, U.S. News, Fortune, has written a lot about the U.S. auto industry. If you're interested in finding out some more about him, you can look at his website, which is williamholstein.com. Mr. Holstein, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to a generous gift from Robert and Alice Campbell. Support for the broadcast today also comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. And that's it for us here on Focus, but there's more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. Host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be Andrea Wolf, author of The Brother Gardeners, Botany Empire and the Birth of an Obsession. Britain is often described as a nation of gardeners. The passion for gardening began to take hold in the 18th century. And our guest this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the program says it was a garden revolution with its roots in America. We'll talk with Andrea Wolf this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, May wheat is trading at $6.29, down one half. July, $6.29, down five. In Chicago, May wheat 572¾, down 7¾. July 582, down 8¾. May corn 421½, up 8. July 428¼, up 7. September 436¾, up 7¼. December 448, up 7¾. May soybeans 1130, unchanged. July 1107¾, down 8¼. August 1068, down 8. September 1019½, down 5½. November 982, down 1. May soybean meal 361.50, down 90. May oil 39.41, that's up 13. Livestock contracts, June live cattle 83.15, down 12½. August 83.60, down 30. May feeder cattle 99.30, down 25. August 101.45, down 15. May lean hog.